But he also saw the value in Project Horizon, even though he was in no position to dismantle NASA or order NASA to cede control to the Army for the development of a base on the moon. But I think we eventually made our point to the president because he ultimately saw the value in a moon base. Shortly after I testified before the Senate in a closed, top-secret session about how the KGB had penetrated the CIA and was actually dictating some of our intelligence estimates since before the Korean War, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, who read that secret testimony, asked me to come over to the Justice Department for a visit. We came to a meeting of the minds that day. I knew that I convinced him that the official intelligence the president was receiving through the agencies was not only faulty, it was deliberately flawed. Robert Kennedy began to see that those of us over at the Pentagon were not just a bunch of old soldiers looking for a war. He saw that we really did see a threat, and that the United States was truly compromised by Soviet penetration of our most secret agencies. We didn't talk about Roswell or any aliens. I never told him about extraterrestrials, but I was able to convince him that if the Soviets got to the moon before we did, victory in the Cold War might just belong to them by the end of the decade. Bobby Kennedy suspected there was another agenda to the Army's desire to deploy a lunar outpost for military as well as for scientific and commercial purposes, and without ever acknowledging that agenda, promised that he would talk about it with the president. I can only tell you that it was a mark of achievement for me personally when President John Kennedy announced to the nation shortly after my meeting with Bobby at the Justice Department that it was one of his goals that the United States put a manned expedition on the moon before the end of the 1960s. He got it! Maybe he couldn't let the Army have another Manhattan Project. That was another era and another war. But Jack Kennedy did understand, I believe, the real consequences of the Cold War and what might have happened if the Russians had put a manned lander on the moon before we did. The way history turned out, it was our lunar expeditions, one after the other, throughout the 1960s, that not only caught the world's attention, but showed all of our enemies that the United States was determined to stake out its territory and defend the moon. Nobody was looking for an out-and-out war, especially the EBEs, who tried to scare us away from the moon and their own base there more times than I even know. They buzzed our ships, interfered with our communications, and sought to threaten us by their physical presence. But we continued and persevered. Ultimately, we reached the moon and sent enough manned expeditions to explore the lunar surface that they effectively challenged the EBEs for control over our own skies and sphere of space, the very sphere General Trudeau was talking about in the Project Horizon memoranda 10 years earlier. And although the Horizon proposal projected a lunar landing by 1965 and an operational base by 1967, it presupposed that the Army would begin creating the bureaucracy to manage the effort and build the hardware as early as 1959. Because of NASA and civilian management of space exploration, the United States took longer to reach the moon than we had originally assumed, and of course, never did build a permanent base we had planned for in the original Horizon proposal. I knew, even though I was no longer in the Army in 1965, that our success at lunar exploration had demonstrated that we were exercising control and that the EBEs would not have free rein over our skies. It also demonstrated that if there were any deals to be made, any proxy relationships to establish, the Soviets were not the ones to deal with. By the beginning of the 1970s, as the Apollo lunar landings continued, it was clear that the tide had turned and we had gained some of the advantage in dealing with the EBEs that we were seeking way back in the 1950s. But for me, back in 1961, staring at the Mammoth Project Horizon report on my desk and realizing that the entire civilian science establishment was mobilizing against the endeavor, I knew that small victories would have to suffice until the big ones could be won, and I took out the printed silicon wafers we'd pulled from the Roswell spacecraft wreckage and told myself that these would comprise the next project I would get into development. I barely knew what they were, but if the scientists at the White Sands Proving Grounds were right about what they portended, this was a victory we would relish long after the political battles over Project Horizon were over. Chapter 12. The Integrated Circuit Chip. From the Roswell crash site to Silicon Valley. With the Night Vision Image Intensifier project underway at Fort Belvoir, and the Project Horizon team trying to swim upstream against the tide of civilian management of the U.S. space program, I turned my attention to the next of the Roswell crash fragments that looked especially intriguing, the charred semiconductor wafers that had broken off some larger device. I hadn't made these my priorities at first, not knowing what they really were, until General Trudeau asked me to take a closer look.
"Talk to some of the rocket scientists out at Alamogordo about these things, Phil," he said. "I think they'll know what we should do with them."
I knew that in the days immediately following the crash, General Twining had met with the Alamogordo group of the Air Materiel Command and had described some of the debris to them. But I didn't know how detailed his descriptions were or whether they even knew about the wafers we had in our file.
"I want to talk to some of the scientists up there, too," I said. "Especially, I want to see some of the engineers from the defense contractors. Maybe they can figure out what the engineering process is for these things."
"Go over to Bell Labs, Phil," General Trudeau also suggested. "The transistor came out of their shop, and these things look a lot like transistorized circuits."
I'd heard that General Twining had worked very closely with both Bell Labs and Motorola on communications research during the war. Afterwards, at the Alamogordo test site for V-2 missile launches, and after the Roswell crash. Whether he had brought them any material from the crash or showed them the tiny silicon chips was a matter of pure speculation. I only know that the entire field of circuit miniaturization took a giant leap in 1947 with the invention of the transistor and the first solid-state components. By the late 1950s, transistors had replaced the vacuum tubes and radios and had turned the wall-size wooden box of the 1940s into the portable plastic radios you could hear blaring away at the shore on a hot July Sunday. The electronics industry had taken a major technological jump in less than 10 years, and I had to wonder privately whether any Roswell material had gotten out that I didn't know about prior to my taking over the Foreign Technology Desk in 1961. I didn't realize it at first when I showed those silicon wafers to General Trudeau, but I was to become very quickly and intimately involved with the burgeoning computer industry and a very small, completely invisible cog in an assembly line process that 15 years later would result in the first microcomputer systems and the personal computer revolution. Over the course of the years since I joined the Army in 1942, my career took me through the stages of vacuum tube-based devices like our radios and radars in World War II to component chassis. These were large circuitry units that, if they went down, could be changed in sections, smaller sections, and finally to tiny transistors and transistorized electronic components. The first Army computers I saw were room-sized, clanking, vacuum tube monsters that were always breaking down and, by today's standards, took an eternity to calculate even the simplest of answers. They were simply oil-filled data pots, but they amazed those of us who had never seen computers work before. At Red Canyon and in Germany, the tracking and targeting radars we used were controlled by the new transistorized chassis computers that were compact enough to fit onto a truck and travel with the battalion. So when I opened up my nut file and saw the charred, matte, gray, quarter-sized, cracker-shaped silicon wafers with the grid lines etched onto them like tiny printed lines on the cover of a matchbook, I could make an educated guess about their function even though I'd never seen anything of the like before. I knew, however, that our rocket scientists and the university researchers who worked with the development laboratories at Bell, Motorola, and IBM would more than understand the primary function of these chips and figure out what we needed to do to make some of our own. But first, I called Professor Hermann Oberth for basic background on what, if any, development might have taken place after the Roswell crash. Dr. Oberth knew the Alamogordo scientists and probably received secondhand the substance of the conversations General Twining had with his Alamogordo group in the hours after the retrieval of the vehicle. And if General Twining described some of the debris, did he describe these little silicon chips? And if he did, in those months when the ENIAC, the first working computer, was just cranking up at the Aberdeen Ordnance Testing Grounds in Maryland, what did the scientists make of these chips? "They saw these at the Walker Field hangar," Dr. Oberth told me. "All of them at Alamogordo flew over to Roswell with General Twining to oversee the shipment to Wright Field." Oberth described what happened that day after the crash when a team of AMC rocket scientists pored over the bits and pieces of debris from the site. Some of the debris was packed for flight on B-29s. Other material, especially the crates that wound up at Fort Riley, were loaded onto deuce-and-a-halves for the drive. Dr. Oberth said that years later von Braun had told him how the scientists who literally had to stand in line to have their equations processed by the experimental computer in Aberdeen, Maryland, were in awe of the microscopic circuitry etched into the charred wafer chips that had spilled out of the craft. Von Braun had asked General Twining whether anyone at Bell Labs was going to be contacted about the find. Twining seemed surprised at first, but when von Braun told him about the experiments on solid-state components, material whose electrons don't need to be excited by heat in order to conduct current, Twining became intrigued. What if these chips were components of a very advanced solid-state circuitry? Von Braun asked him. What if one of the reasons the Army could find no electronic wiring on the craft were the layers of these wafers that ran through the entire ship? These circuit chips could be the nervous system of the craft, carrying signals and transmitting commands just like the nervous system in a human body. General Twining's only experience had been with the heavily insulated vacuum tube devices from World War II, where the multi-strand wires were covered with cloth. He'd never seen metallic printed chips like these before. "How do they work?" he asked von Braun. The German scientist wasn't sure, although he guessed they worked on the same principle as the transistors that laboratories were trying to develop to the point where they could be manufactured commercially. "It would completely transform the electronics industry," von Braun explained to General Twining. "Nothing short of a revolution." The Germans had been desperately trying to develop circuitry of this sort during the war, but Hitler, convinced the war would be over by 1941, told the German computer researchers that the Wehrmacht had no need for computers that had a development timetable greater than 1 year. They'd all be celebrating victory in Berlin before the end of the year. But the research into solid-state components that the Germans had been doing and the early work at Bell Labs was nothing compared to the marvel that Twining had shown von Braun and the other rocket scientists in New Mexico. Under the magnifying glass, the group thought they saw not just a single solid-state switch, but a whole system of switches integrated into each other and comprising what looked like an entire circuit or system of circuits. They couldn't be sure because no one had ever seen anything even remotely like this before, but it showed them an image of what the future of electronics could be if a way could be found to manufacture this kind of circuit on Earth. Suddenly, the huge guidance control systems necessary to control the flight of a rocket, which, in 1947, were too big to be squeezed into the fuselage of the rocket, could be miniaturized so that the rocket could have its own automatic guidance system. If we could duplicate what the EBEs had, we too would have the ability to explore space. In effect, the reverse engineering of solid-state integrated circuitry began in the weeks and months after the crash, even though William Shockley at Bell Labs was already working on a version of his transistor as early as 1946. In the summer of 1947, the scientists at Alamogordo were only aware of the solid-state circuit research underway at Bell Labs and Motorola, so they pointed Nathan Twining to research scientists at both companies and agreed to help him conduct the very early briefings into the nature of the Roswell find. The Army, very covertly, turned some of the components over to research engineers for an inspection. And by the early 1950s, the transistor had been invented, and transistorized circuits were now turning up in consumer products as well as in military electronic systems. The era of the vacuum tube, the single piece of 80-year-old technology upon which an entire generation of communications devices, including television and digital computers, was built, was now coming to a close, with the discovery in the desert of an entirely new technology. The radio vacuum tube was a legacy of 19th century experimentation with electric current. Like many historic scientific discoveries, the theory behind the vacuum tube was uncovered almost by chance, and nobody really knew what it was or cared much about it until years later. The radio vacuum tube probably reached its greatest utility from the 1930s through the 1950s, until the technology we discovered at Roswell made it all but obsolete. The principle behind the radio vacuum tube, first discovered by Thomas Edison in the 1880s while he was experimenting with different components for his incandescent light bulb, was that current, which typically flowed in either direction across a conductive material, such as a wire, could be made to flow in only one direction when passed through a vacuum. This directed flow of current, called the Edison effect, is the scientific principle behind the illumination of the filament material inside the vacuum of the incandescent light bulb, a technology that has remained remarkably the same for over 100 years. But the light bulb technology that Edison discovered back in the 1880s then put aside, only to experiment with it again in the early 20th century, also had another equally important function. Because the flow of electrons across the single filament wire went only in one direction, the vacuum tube was also a type of automatic switch. Excite the flow of electrons across the wire, and the current flowed only in the direction you wanted it to. You didn't need to throw a switch to turn on a circuit manually because the vacuum tube could do that for you. Edison had actually discovered the first automatic switching device, which could be applied to hundreds of electronic products from the radio sets that I grew up with in the 1920s to the communications networks and radar banks of World War II and to the television sets of the 1950s. In fact, the radio tube was the single component that enabled us to begin the worldwide communications network that was already in place by the early 20th century. Radio vacuum tubes also had another important application that wasn't discovered until experimenters in the infant science of computers first recognized the need for them in the 1930s, and then again in the 1940s. Because they were switches, opening and closing circuits, they could be programmed to reconfigure a computer to accomplish different tasks. The computer itself had, in principle, remained essentially the same type of calculating device that Charles Babbage first invented in the 1830s. It was a set of internal gears or wheels that acted as counters and a section of memory that stored numbers until it was their turn to be processed. Babbage's computer was operated manually by a technician who threw the mechanical switches in order to input raw numbers and execute the program that processed the numbers. The simple principle behind the first computer, called by its inventor the analytical engine, was that the same machine could process an infinite variety and types of calculations by reconfiguring its parts through a switching mechanism. The machine had a component for inputting numbers or instructions to the processor, the processor itself, which completed the calculations, and a central control unit, or CPU, that organized and sequenced the tasks to make sure the machine was doing the right job at the right time, a memory area for storing numbers, and finally a component that output the results of the calculations to a type of printer, the same basic components you find in all computers even today. The same machine could add, subtract, multiply, or divide, and even store numbers from one arithmetical process to the next. It could even store the arithmetical computation instructions themselves from job to job. And Babbage borrowed a punch card process invented by Joseph Jacquard for programming weaving looms. Babbage's programs could be stored on series of punch cards and fed into the computer to control the sequence of processing numbers. Though this may sound like a startling invention, it was the Industrial Revolution technology that began in the late 18th century for the purely utilitarian challenge of processing large numbers for the British military. Yet, in concept, it was an entirely new principle in machine design that very quietly started the digital revolution. Because Babbage's machine was hand-powered and cumbersome, little was done with it through the 19th century, and by the 1880s, Babbage himself would be forgotten. However, the practical application of electricity to mechanical appliances and the delivery of electrical power along supply grids invented by Thomas Edison and refined by Nikola Tesla gave new life to the calculation machine. The concept of an automatic calculation machine would inspire American inventors to devise their own electrically powered calculators to process large numbers in a competition to calculate the 1890 U.S. Census. The winner of the competition was Hermann Hollerith, whose electrically powered calculator was a monster device that not only processed numbers, but displayed the progress of the process on large clocks for all to see. He was so successful that the large railroad companies hired him to process their numbers. By the turn of the century, his company, the Computing, Tabulating, and Recording Company, had become the single largest developer of automatic calculating machines. By 1929, when Hollerith died, his company had become the automation conglomerate IBM. Right about the time of Hollerith's death, a German engineer named Konrad Zuse approached some of the same challenges that had confronted Charles Babbage 100 years earlier. How to build his own version of a universal computing machine that could reconfigure itself depending upon the type of calculation the operator wanted to perform. Zeus decided that
instead of working with a machine that operated on the decimal system, which limited the types of arithmetic calculations it could perform, his machine would use only two numbers, 0 and 1, the binary system. This meant that he could process any type of mathematical equation through the opening or closing of a series of electromagnetic relays, switches, that would act as valves or gates, either letting current through or shutting it off. These relays were the same types of devices that the large telephone companies, like the Bell system in the United States, were using as the basis of their networks. By marrying an electrical power supply and electric switches to the architecture of Babbage's analytical engine, and basing his computations in a binary instead of a decimal system, Zeus had come up with the European version of the first electrical digital computer, an entirely new device. It was just 3 years before the German invasion of Poland and the outbreak of World War II. In the United States, at about the same time as Zeus was assembling his first computer in his parents' living room, Harvard mathematics professor Howard Aiken was trying to reconstruct a theoretical version of Babbage's computer, also using electromagnetic relays as switching devices and relying on a binary number system. The difference between Aiken and Zeus was that Aiken had academic credentials, and his background as an innovative mathematician got him into the office of Thomas Watson, president of IBM, to whom he presented his proposal for the first American digital computer. Watson was impressed, authorized a budget for $1 million, and right before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the project design was started up at Cambridge, Massachusetts. It was then moved to IBM headquarters in New York during the war. Because of their theoretical ability to calculate large sets of numbers in a relatively short period of time, digital computers were drafted into the war effort in the United Kingdom as a code-breaking device. By 1943, at the same time that IBM's first shiny stainless steel version of Aiken's computer was up and running in Endicott, New York, the British were using their dedicated crypto-analytical Colossus computer to break the German codes and decipher the code-creating ability of the German Enigma, the code machine that the Nazis believed made their transmissions indecipherable to the Allies. Unlike the IBM Aiken computer at Harvard and Conrad Zuse's experimental computer in Berlin, the Colossus used radio vacuum tubes as relay switches and was therefore hundreds of times faster than any experimental computer using electromagnetic relays. The Colossus, therefore, was a true breakthrough because it married the speed of vacuum tube technology with the component design of the analytical engine to create the first modern-era digital computer. The British used the Colossus so effectively that they quickly felt the need to build more of them to process the increasingly large volume of encrypted transmissions the Germans were sending, ignorant of the fact that the Allies were decoding every word and outsmarting them at every turn. I would argue, even to this day, that the technological advantage the Allies enjoyed in intelligence-gathering apparatus, specifically code-breaking computers and radar, enabled us to win the war despite Hitler's initial successes and his early weapons advantages. The Allies' use of the digital computer in World War II was an example of how a superior technological advantage can make the difference between victory and defeat, no matter what kinds of weapons or numbers of troops the enemy is able to deploy. The American and British experience with computers during the war and our government's commitment to developing a viable digital computer led to the creation, in the years immediately following the war, of a computer called the Electronic Numerical Integrator and Calculator, or ENIAC. ENIAC was the brainchild of Howard Aiken and one of our Army R&D brain trust advisors, the mathematician John von Neumann. Although it operated on a decimal instead of a binary system and had a very, very small memory, it relied on radio vacuum tube switching technology. For its time, it was the first of what today are called number crunchers. When measured against the way computers developed over the years since its first installation, especially the personal computer of today, ENIAC was something of a real dinosaur. It was loud, hot, cumbersome, fitful, and required the power supply of an entire town to keep it going. It couldn't stay up for very long because the radio tubes, always unreliable even under the best working conditions, would blow out after only a few hours' work and had to be replaced. But the machine worked. It crunched the numbers it was fed, and it showed the way for the next model, which reflected the sophisticated, symbolic architectural design of John von Neumann. Von Neumann suggested that instead of feeding the computer the programs you wanted it to run every time you turned it on, the programs themselves could be stored in the computer permanently. By treating the programs themselves as components of the machine stored right in the hardware, the computer could change between programs or the routines of subprograms as necessary in order to solve problems. This meant that larger routines could be processed into subroutines, which themselves could be organized into templates to solve similar problems. In complex applications, programs could call up other programs again and again without the need of human intervention and could even change the subprograms to fit the application. Von Neumann had invented block programming, the basis for the sophisticated engineering and business programming of the late 1950s and 60s and the great-great-grandmother of today's object-oriented programming. By 1947, it had all come together. The design of the machine, the electrical power supply, the radio vacuum tube technology, the logic of machine processing, von Neumann's mathematical architecture, and practical applications for the computer's use. But just a few years shy of the midpoint of the century, the computer itself was the product of the 18th and 19th century thinking and technology. In fact, given the shortcomings of the radio tube and the enormous power demand and cooling requirements to keep the computer working, the development of the computer seemed to have come to a dead end. Although IBM and Bell Labs were investing large sums of development money into designing a computer that had a lower operational and maintenance overhead, it seemed, given the technology of the digital computer circa 1947, that there was no place it could go. It was simply an expensive to build, expensive to run, lumbering elephant at the end of the line. And then, an alien spacecraft fell out of the skies over Roswell, scattered across the desert floor, and in one evening, everything changed. In 1948, the first junction transistor, a microscopically thin silicon sandwich of N-type silicon, in which some of the atoms had an extra electron, and P-type silicon, in which some of the atoms have one less electron, was devised by physicist William Shockley. The invention was credited to Bell Telephone Laboratories, and, as if by magic, the dead end that had stopped the development of the dinosaur-like ENIAC generation of computers melted away, and an entirely new generation of miniaturized circuitry began. Where the radio tube circuit required an enormous power supply to heat it up, because heat generated the electricity, the transistor required very low levels of powers, and no heating up time, because the transistor amplified the stream of electrons that flowed into its base. Because it required only a low level of current, it could be powered by batteries, because it didn't rely on a heat source to generate current, and it was so small
many transistors could be packed into a very small space, allowing for the miniaturization of circuitry components. Finally, because it didn't burn out like the radio tube, it was much more reliable. Thus, within months after the Roswell crash and the first exposure of the silicon wafer technology to companies already involved in the research and development of computers, the limitations on the size and power of the computer suddenly dropped like the removal of a roadblock on a highway, and the next generation of computers went into development. This set up for Army R&D, especially during the years I was there, the opportunity for us to encourage that development with defense contracts calling for the implementation of integrated circuit devices into subsequent generations of weapon systems. More than one historian of the microcomputer age has written that no one before 1947 foresaw the invention of the transistor or had even dreamed about an entirely new technology that relied on semiconductors, which were silicon-based and not carbon-based, like the Edison incandescent tube. Bigger than the idea of a calculating machine, or an analytical engine, or any combination of the components that made up the first computers in the 1930s and 1940s, the invention of the transistor and its natural evolution to the silicon chip of integrated circuitry was beyond what anyone could call a quantum leap of technology. The entire development arc of the radio tube, from Edison's first experiments with filament for his incandescent light bulb to the vacuum tubes that formed the switching mechanisms of ENIAC, lasted about 50 years. The development of the silicon transistor seemed to come upon us in a matter of months, and had I not seen the silicon wafers from the Roswell crash with my own eyes, held them in my own hands, talked about them with Hermann Oberth, Wernher von Braun, or Hans Kohler, and heard the reports from these now-dead scientists of the meetings between Nathan Twining, Vannevar Bush, and researchers at Bell Labs, I would have thought the invention of the transistor was a miracle. I know now how it came about. As history revealed, the invention of the transistor was only the beginning of an integrated circuit technology that developed through the 1950s and continues right through the present. By the time I became personally involved in 1961, the American marketplace had already witnessed the retooling of Japan and Germany in the 1950s, and Korea and Taiwan in the late 1950s through the early 1960s. General Trudeau was concerned about this, not because he considered these countries our economic enemies, but because he believed that American industry would suffer as a result of its complacency about their basic research and development. He expressed this to me on many occasions during our meetings, and history has proved him to be correct. General Trudeau believed that the American industrial economy enjoyed a harvest of technology in the years immediately following World War II, the effects of which were still underway in the 1960s, but that it would soon slow down because R&D was an inherently costly undertaking that didn't immediately contribute to a company's bottom line. And you had to have a good bottom line, General Trudeau always said, to keep your stockholders happy, or else they would revolt and throw out the existing management team right out of the company. By throwing their efforts into the bottom line, Trudeau said, the big American industries were actually destroying themselves, just like a family that spends all of its savings. You have to keep on investing in yourself, Phil, the general would say when he'd look up from his Wall Street Journal before our morning meetings and remark about how stock analysts always like to place their value on the wrong thing. Sure, these companies have to make a profit, but you look at the Japanese and the Germans, and they know the value of basic research, he once said to me. American companies expect the government to pay for all their research, and that's what you and I have to do if we want to keep them working. But there's going to come a time when we can't afford to pay for it any longer. Then who's going to foot the bill? General Trudeau was worrying about how the drive for new electronics products
based on miniaturized circuitry was creating entirely new markets that were shutting out American companies. He said that it was becoming cheaper for American companies to have their products manufactured for them in Asia, where companies had already retooled after the war to produce transistorized components, than for American companies, which had heavily invested in the manufacturing technology of the 19th century, to do it themselves. He knew that the requirement for space exploration, for challenging the hostile EBEs in their own territory, relied on the development of an integrated circuit technology so that the electronic components of spacecraft could be miniaturized to fit the size requirements of rocket-propelled vehicles. The race to develop more intelligent missiles and ordnance also required the development of new types of circuitry that could be packed into smaller and smaller spaces. But retooled Japanese and German industries were the only ones able to take immediate advantage of what General Trudeau called the new electronics. For American industry to get onto the playing field, the basic research would have to be paid for by the military. It was something General Trudeau was willing to fight for at the Pentagon because he knew that it was the only way we could get the weapons only a handful of us knew we needed to fight a skirmish war against aliens only a handful of us knew we were fighting. Arthur Trudeau was a battlefield general engaged in a lonely military campaign that national policy and secrecy laws forbade him even to talk about. And as the gulf of time widened between the Roswell crash and the concerns over post-war economic expansion, even the people who were fighting the war alongside General Trudeau were, one by one, beginning to die away. Industry could fight the war for us, General Trudeau believed, if it was properly seeded with ideas and the money to develop them. By 1961, we had turned our attention to the integrated circuit. Government military weapons spending and the requirements of space exploration had already heavily funded the transistorized component circuit. The radars and missiles I was commanding at Red Canyon, New Mexico in 1958 relied on miniaturized components for their reliability and portability. New generations of tracking radars on the drawing boards in 1960 were even more sophisticated and electronically intelligent than the weapons I was aiming at Soviet targets in Germany. In the United States, Japanese and Taiwanese radios that fit into the palm of your hand were on the market. Computers like ENIAC, once the size of a small warehouse, now occupied rooms no larger than closets, and while still generating heat, no longer blew out because of overheated radio vacuum tubes. Mini computers, helped by government R&D funding, were still a few years away from the market, but were already in a design phase. Television sets and stereophonic phonographs that offered solid-state electronics were coming on the market. And companies like IBM, Sperry Rand, and NCR were beginning to bring electronic office machines onto the market. It was the beginning of a new age of electronics, helped, in part, by government funding of basic research into the development and manufacture of integrated circuit products. But the real prize, the development of what actually had been recovered at Roswell, was still a few years away. When it arrived, again spurred by the requirements of military weapons development and space travel, it caused another revolution. The history of the printed circuit and the microprocessor is also the history of a technology that allowed engineers to squeeze more and more circuitry into a smaller and smaller place. It's the history of the integrated circuit, which developed throughout the 1960s, evolved into large-scale integration in the 1970s, very large-scale integration by the middle 1970s, just before the emergence of the first real personal computers
and ultra-large-scale integration by the early 1980s. Today's 200-plus megahertz multi-gigabyte hard drive desktop computers are the results of the integrated circuit technology that began in the 1960s and has continued to the present. The jump from the basic transistorized integrated printed circuit of the 1960s to large-scale integration was made possible by the development of the microprocessor in 1972. Once the development process of engineering a more tightly compacted circuit had been inspired by the invention of the transistor in 1948 and fueled by the need to develop better, faster, and smaller computers, it continued on a natural progression until the engineers at Intel developed the first microprocessor, a 4-bit central processing unit called the 4004, in 1972. This year marked the beginning of the microcomputer industry, although the first personal microcomputers didn't appear on the market until the development of Intel's 8080A. That computer chip was the heart of the Altair computer, the first product to package a version of a high-level programming language called BASIC, which allowed non-engineering types to program the machine and create applications for it. Soon, companies like Motorola and Zilog had their own microprocessors on the market, and by 1977, the Motorola 6502-powered Apple II was on the market, joined by the 8080A Radio Shack, the Commodore PET, the Atari, and the Heathkit. Operationally, at its very heart, the microprocessor shares the same binary functions and large arrays of digital switches as its ancestors, the big mainframes of the 1950s and the 1960s, and the transistorized minis of the late 1960s and early 1970s. Functionally, the microprocessor also shares the same kinds of tasks as Charles Babbage's analytical engine of the 1830s. Reading numbers, storing numbers, logically processing numbers, and outputting the results. The microprocessor just puts everything into a much smaller space and moves it along at a much faster speed. In 1979, Apple Computer had begun selling the first home computer floppy disk operating system for data and program storage that kicked the microcomputer revolution into a higher gear. Not only could users input data via a keyboard or tape cassette player, they could store relatively large amounts of data such as documents or mathematical projection on transportable, erasable, and interchangeable Mylar disks that the computer was able to read. Now the computer reached beyond the electronics hobbyist into the workplace. By the end of the year, MicroPro's introduction of the first fully functional word processor called WordStar and Personal Software's release of the very first electronic spreadsheet called VisiCalc so transformed the workplace that the desktop computer became a necessity for any young executive on his or her way up the corporate ladder. And by the early 1980s, with the introduction of the Apple Macintosh and the object-oriented computer environment, not only the workplace, but the whole world looked like a very different place than it did in the early 1960s. Even Dr. Vannevar Bush's concept of a type of research query language based not on a linear outline, but on the intellectual relationship to something embedded in a body of text became a reality with the release of a computer program by Apple called HyperCard. It was as if, from 1947 to 1980, a fundamental paradigm shift in the ability of humankind to process information took place. Computers themselves almost became something like a silicon-based life form, inspiring the carbon-based life forms on planet Earth to develop them, grow them, and even help them reproduce.
With computer-directed process control programs now in place in virtually all major industries, software that writes software, neural network-based expert systems that learn from their own experience in the real world, and even current experiments underway to grow almost microscopically thin silicon-based chips in the weightless environment of Earth orbit may be the forerunner of a time when automated orbital factories routinely grow and harvest new silicon material for microprocessors more sophisticated than we can even imagine at the present. Were all of this to be true, could it not be argued that the silicon wafers we recovered from Roswell were the real masters and space travelers and the EBE creatures their hosts or servants? Once implanted successfully on Earth, our culture having reached a point of readiness through its development of the first digital computers, would not the natural development stream, starting from the invention of the transistor, have carried us to the point where we achieve a symbiotic relationship with the silicon material that carries our data and enables us to become more creative and successful? Maybe. The Roswell crash, which helped us develop the technological basis for the weapon systems to protect our planet from the EBEs, was also the mechanism for successfully implanting a completely alien, non-humanoid life form that survives from host to host like a virus, a digital Ebola that we humans will carry to another planet someday. Or what if an enemy wanted to implant the perfect spying or sabotage mechanism into a culture? Then the implantation of the microchip-based circuit into our technology by the EBEs would be the perfect method. Was it implanted as sabotage or as something akin to the gift of fire? Maybe the Roswell crash in 1947 was an event waiting to happen, like poisoned fruit dropping from the tree into a playground. Once bitten, the poison takes effect. "Hold your horses, Phil," General Trudeau would say when I would speculate too much. "Remember, you've got a bunch of scientists you need to talk to, and the people at Bell Labs are waiting to see a report when you finish talking to the Alamogordo group." It was 1961, and the miniaturization of computer and electronic circuitry had already begun. But my report to the general, and appointments he was arranging for me at Sperry Rand, Hughes, and Bell Labs, were for meetings with scientists to determine how their respective companies were proceeding with applying miniaturized circuitry into designs for weapon systems. The inspiration for microcircuitry had fallen out of the sky at Roswell and set the development of digital computers off in an entirely new direction. It was my job now to use the process of weapons development, especially the development of guidance systems for ballistic missiles, to implement the application of microcircuitry systems to these new generations of weapons. General Trudeau and I were among the first scouts on what would be the electronic battlefield of the 1980s. "Don't worry, General. I've got my appointments all set up," I told him. I knew how carried away I could get, but I was an intelligence officer first, and that meant you start with a blank page and fill it in. "But I think the people at Bell Labs have already seen these things before." And they actually did, in 1947. Chapter 13, The Laser. As I worked my way through the list of items in my nut file, writing advisory reports and recommendations to General Trudeau about the potential of each item, I lost all concept of time. I could see, as I drove up and down the Potomac shore to Fort Belvoir to check on the progress of night vision at Martin Marietta, that summer was coming to an end, and the leaves had started to change color.
I could also see that now it was getting already dark when I left the Pentagon, and it was dark now when I set out for the Pentagon every morning. I'd gotten into the habit of taking different routes to work just to make sure that if the CIA had put a tail on me, I'd make him work harder to stay up with me. General Trudeau and I had settled down into a long daily routine ourselves at R&D. We had our early morning meetings about the Roswell file. He also called it the junk pile because it was filled with so much debris and pieces of items that had broken away from larger components. But we had buried the Roswell material development projects themselves so deep inside the regular functions of the R&D division that not even the other officers who worked with us every day knew what was going on. We'd categorized the work we did so carefully that when it came time to discuss anything about Roswell, even if it had a bearing on some other item we were working on at the time, we made sure that either no one was at the office, or we were at a place where we wouldn't have to stop talking just because someone came into the room. My responsibility at Foreign Technology was to feed R&D's ongoing project development with information and intelligence from sources outside the regular Army channels. These ran in interconnected rings through the Pentagon to defense industry contractors, to testing operations at Army bases, and to researchers at universities or independent laboratories who were under contract with us. If we were developing methods of preserving food, always trying to come up with a better way to prepare field rations, and the Italians and Germans had a process that seemed to work, it was my job to learn about it and slip the information into the development process. Even when there was no official development process underway for a specific item, if something I learned was appropriate to any one of the Army's major commands, whether it was the Medical Corps, the Signal Corps, the Motor Pool, Ordnance, or even the Quartermaster Corps, it was also my job to find a way to make that information appropriate and drop it in without so much as a splash. This made the perfect cover for what I was doing with the Roswell file, as long as I could find ways to slip the Roswell technology into the development process so invisibly, no one would ever be able to find the Roswell on-ramp to the information highway. For all the world to see, General Trudeau and I regularly met to review the ongoing projects in Army R&D, those we had inherited from the previous command, and those we wanted to initiate on our watch. Officers who'd been assigned to R&D before we arrived had their own projects already in development, too, and the general had assigned me the task of feeding those projects with information and intelligence, no matter where it came from, without disturbing either what the officers were doing or interfering with their staffs. It was tricky, because I had to work in the dark, undercover, even from my own colleagues whose reputations would have been destroyed if word leaked out that they were dealing in flying saucer stuff. Yet at the same time, most high-ranking officers at the Pentagon and key members of their staffs knew that Roswell technology was floating through most of the new projects under development. They were also vaguely, if not specifically, aware of what had happened at Roswell itself and of the current version of the Hillenkoetter-Bush Twining Working Group, which had personnel stationed at the Pentagon to keep tabs on what the military was doing. Uniting what I called my official day job at R&D on regular projects and my undercover job in the Roswell file was my official but many times informal role as General Trudeau's deputy at the division. In that job, I would carry out the general's orders as they related to the division and not specifically to any one project or another. If General Trudeau needed information to help him redefine his budgetary priorities or assemble information to help compile supplementary development budgets, he'd often ask me to help or at least give him advice. And I functioned as the general's intelligence officer as well, supporting him at meetings with information helping him present position papers, assisting him whenever he had to hold briefings or meet with congressional committees, and defending him and the division against the almost weekly attacks on our turf from